It's time to play big on Moto Social Casino, America's hottest free-to-play social casino experience. Moto.us has live casino games. It's time! Play big, win bigger on Moto.us today.
Moto is a social casino, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Visit Moto.us for more details.
It's time!
Moto.us.
Hexasort by Lion Studios. The original hex sorting game. Sort, organize, and stack. Satisfying color matches reveal power-ups, boosters, and more. You'll crave the play. It's a mental workout. Download Hexasort today at the App Store or on Google Play. Hexasort by Lion Studios. The original hex sorting game. Download today.
How'd you like to listen to .NET Rocks with no ads? Easy. Become a patron. For just $5 a month, you get access to a private RSS feed where all the shows have no ads. $20 a month will get you that and a special .NET Rocks patron mug. Sign up now at patreon.dotnetrocks.com.
Hey, guess what? It's .NET Rocks. I'm Carl Franklin.
And I'm Richard Camp.
And it's been a while since we just recorded one last week's show. We recorded about an hour ago, but before that, it's been
a month because I went on the road for a month, right? I did a couple of weeks in Mexico just to get out of the gray because that's the challenge of living up here. And then NDC, London.
I saw the nice posts you did from Mexico with our friends, Paul and Stephanie.
Yep, they came down for a week with us, and then I was in NDC, London, and then Svitag in Stockholm.
Very cool. So you saw Fritz there, I believe.
I did. The Fritzy was there. The Hunter was there. The Hanselman.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, I know. An excess of Scots, to be honest.
I will be at the other Stockholm conference, DevSum.
Yeah, I'm looking at being there as well, so maybe we can record some stuff.
Yeah, maybe. I think the weather will be a little nicer when I'm there.
Yeah, it'll be probably June, I think.
Just timing. Okay, let's get into Better Know Framework.
All right, man, what do you got?
At long last, Music to Code By, track 22, is available.
Oh my goodness, it's been a while.
Is available for download. And it's been added into the collection, in the Wave collection, in the Flack collection. And you can go get it at musictocodeby.net.
Awesome.
But that's not the only thing. Maybe, should we play just a little bit of it?
Yeah, you should.
All right, I should. Go ahead. So there you go. That's just a little bit of it.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I do have an announcement around this whole Music to Code By, Music to Flow By, whatever thing. So Music to Code By, you know, it started long ago as a project that was on Kickstarter. Did an album with three tracks and sent out a CD. And then I started making more tracks and selling them digitally. And it all was going pretty well. And it kind of slowed down quite a lot. And then every once in a while, I'd throw out another track every year, every couple of years. And I really wanted to market it outside of developers because the developers are the only ones who know what Music to Code By is. And anybody else looks at that and says, I don't code. What do I need this for?
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to market it as a, you know, a relaxation, a focus tool to the broader audience. So I tried Music to Flow By. Well, that didn't really work either. And so I'm rebranding it yet again, and it's going to be called Magic Focus Music.
Interesting.
Yeah, because I think that kind of describes what it is. And I don't want to do this as an app. And here's why. I'm basically charging for access to this music, right?
Right.
And if you do an app, then you have to go through the App Store in
30%.
purchases, give them 30%. What a racket that is. So I'm building a website. It'll be mobile friendly. You'll sign up. You'll buy your stuff. It's going to be subscription. It's going to be affordable. And because I also figure that people are going to mostly use this like in their laptops, when they're working on their laptops, when they're on their desktop. So I don't really foresee anybody putting it on their phone while they're using their phone. Because if they're using their phone, they're not really focusing on anything, are they?
True. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the story. Look for musictoflowby.com. I will mention it on the show when it is available, but I'm working on it right now. And in the meantime, if you want to just download the tracks and manage them yourself, like most developers like to do, go to musictoflowby.net. It's the same stuff. All right. It's exactly the same music. So that's it.
Cool, man.
That's what I got. Who's talking to us today, Richard?
Grabbed a comment off of show 1860, the one we did with Jeremy back in August of 2023.
Which
is long ago than I thought. Talking about minimal architecture. Today, we're going to talk about vertical architecture. But first, we talked about minimal architecture 18 months ago. So Damien had this great comment. He said, hey, great episode. I always enjoy hearing from Jeremy. And it's great to see finally a tapering off of the microservices hype.
Yeah.
I found much greater developer efficiency aggressively building natural, quote, seams. That's S-E-A-M-S, seams, into projects. Version 1 or the test edition might ship as a single process, but built from multiple projects, which can then be easily broken into deployable microservices if and when required. Another approach is to have multiple build versions of a product. One is a single process and others might be split into multiple microservices. And if you get your seams right, the amount of additional work is trivial. It can be a good exercise which forces clean separations as a project grows and allows simple deployments and a fast dev loop when the mega load volumes aren't required. I find it useful to actively try and separate development from ultimate deployment. The vast majority of our business code can run just as well on a watch as in the cloud. Mm-hmm. Although ostensibly ridiculous, I don't know, watch-based development. Approaching design.
As long as it has AI in it.
Yeah, well, of course it'll have to have AI in it. Don't be crazy now.
My coffee cup has AI in it.
Yes, it's my fork. although ostensibly ridiculous, as all AI projects are, approaching designs with the goal of running it on a watch can push towards some good, clean design decisions. I think you got a good insight here, Damien, which is you're pushing on Conway's law that if we organize the project into logical units, those are those become the natural seams. So you start thinking about what are the areas of resonance, like what's likely to change. Keep that separate, and whether you compile it all into one big assembly or not, doesn't matter, right? The deployment is separate from the construction. Yeah. So Damien, thank you so much for your comment and a copy of Music to Code By. It's on its way to you. And if you'd like a copy of Music to Code By, write a comment on the website at .NETrocks.com or on the Facebooks. We publish every show there. And if you comment there and I read on the show, we'll send you a copy of Music to Code.
And you can follow us on the other social medias. We've been on X, Twitter forever. We're also on Mastodon and at Blue Sky, which is really coming along.
Yep.
And some aberration of at Carl Franklin and at Rich Campbell.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So before we introduce Jeremy Miller, let's talk about 1939. Some significant events included the start of World War II.
Yeah, that's kind of a significant event.
Yeah. Germany invaded Poland on September 1st, leading Britain and France to declare war on Germany. Additionally, this year saw the debut of iconic cultural works like The Wizard of Oz and the first NCAA basketball tournament. What do you got on your list, Richard?
You know, I've been doing the future of energy since the Worldwide Energy Geek Out, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
And that finally spun into folks asking me to do talks just on nuclear power.
Right.
Which now I've done for the past year or so. And interesting, curiously, I started doing them before it got really exciting because there really has been a renaissance in nuclear power. Mm-hmm. But one of the cornerstones of that entire story starts in 1939 when Otto Hahn and Lise Meitner, published the paper on splitting a uranium atom for the first time.
Wow.
And interestingly, they calculated the yield of the energy of splitting that atom from Einstein's 1905 paper equals MC squared. And he was absolutely completely right. Like the numbers worked perfectly. So 30 something years before, this guy had figured out, well, if you really could convert matter into energy, this is how much you'd get. And that paper is sort of the foundational piece. Like, first time they intentionally split the atom is 1939. And by 1945, they will deploy the first atomic bomb.
I don't know if it was this paper or which one that after it was proven, they came to Einstein and said, "Professor, you were right. You were right. Isn't that a victory for you?" He says, "No, it's a victory for God."
That's very Einsteinian.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's amazing how quickly all of that happened.
Yeah.
The good news is from that came this paper from the English, the MOD report, that said both we can use this to make energy and we can use this to make weapons. And whereupon they probably did both.
Yeah.
1939, pivotal year.
Mm-hmm. And a pivotal episode of .NET Rocks, because our old friend Jeremy Miller is here. And, if you're younger than us, you might know who he is, but if you've been around for a few years like we have, you'll definitely know. So I'm going to read your bio anyway, Jeremy. Jeremy Miller started his career as a real engineer, that's in quotes, but wandered into software because that looked like more fun. Since then, Jeremy has worked in and led software development teams in the computer manufacturing industry, finance, insurance, healthcare, and banking industries. Lately, Jeremy has been focused on leading software architecture and teams and helping mentor other software architects. And by lately, I mean the last 10 years, right? Having had roles both as an in-house software architect and software consultant, Jeremy has a great deal of insight into the challenges that confront companies developing and maintaining enterprise systems over time. Jeremy is well known for his open source software tools, starting with StructureMap, and continuing to Martin and Wolverine and others. Jeremy is also a frequent author and technical speaker at software conferences and can be found at jeremydmiller.com. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you very much. And very sorry. Let me apologize for writing such a ridiculously long bio for you.
Well, people need to know who you are. And
you're the Kritstadt guy.
And Hibernate Mafia member is not in there, however.
Weird.
Oh, if we could just kindly let that one go by.
A long time ago, man.
That's all right. Nobody remembers.
Yeah, most of your audience is wondering, what is in Hibernate?
All right. We don't need to tell them.
How is the Critter Stack these days?
Yeah.
So the Critter Stack, somebody was making fun of that today, Martin and Wolverine, moving along very well. So at this point, and this the shameless plug part. Mm-hmm. At this point, I would say Martin is the most widely used event sourcing tool in .NET. I think it's by far and away the most robust. I think we had such a huge year last year in terms of feature development. I think I'm ready at the point to say, I think we stand up against any event sourcing infrastructure across any ecosystem.
Nice.
Good.
Wolverine and some other littler things complete the whole Critter Stack. And that's a purposeful theme. Moving really fast on that. And like, one of the specifics we'll talk about is how Wolverine has some special sauce for doing vertical slice architecture, and almost to take the, well, eventually let me take a tangent on your comment from Damien earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's also developing a lot of special sauce for doing modular monoliths. And we might want to talk about why the modular monolith idea is absolutely not a silver bullet. And there's a lot more challenges than I think people are recognizing right now.
Yeah, dude, if there was an easy way to do it, we'd be doing it. Everything is hard.
Yeah.
If it was easy, you could buy it at 7-Eleven.
Everything is definitely hard. You know, we've kept circling back on this idea. I mean, of course, 20 something years of .NET Rocks, we've gone through it all, man. Like, mm-hmm. Remember when SOA was a good idea? And then we talked about the various globs of goo, and now you call them monoliths, and then, this modularization or peeling pieces off. Like, it's a cycle, right? Like, we're all trying to build better software.
SOA was an eye-opener for me, not in the implementation that was suggested at the time, because I thought that was way over-architected, but just the idea of having islands. I thought that was a good idea, and it was one that hadn't occurred to me up to then.
I think you read into it more. So I was at Dell Computers at the time when Dell still manufactured their own stuff. So I'm trying to apply that to, at the time, manufacturing IT, when you have shipping systems and inventory systems and a million and one little one-off things where they may need to want to talk to each other, where you don't want to duplicate as much data. You know, SOA was, it was attractive, at least in theory.
Right.
I don't think anybody wants to reuse any of the mechanisms we used back then,
though. No. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Tooling is always a problem. But this idea that SOA was catching, was basically at the forefront of the fact that we were about to blow the client up, right? That you were going to, phones were going to be real clients. There was going to be multiple devices and multiple platforms, you know, coming out of the Wintel hegemony where you were building on the same machine that everybody was working from, where we didn't have to think about it, all that, which was a weird time. It is, so we said, hey, this back-end code, it'll work for everything. You'll only have to write that once, and now you'll be, you just got a set of services that you can decide what client you want to use.
Yes. That also went a lot easier when we gave up on the full XML SOAP thing. And
oh, Lord, save me from XML.
Yeah. We're old enough. We lived through the...
The WSDL nightmares.
Yeah. Hell.
Or systems that did three or four levels of XML transformation to the point where you had no traceability between up to downstream.
Right. We should never have needed BizTalk.
Yeah. I mean, the origins of BizTalk before the SOAP layer were, you know, pre-internet intercommunications. Like, they were doing serious transformation of data for connecting between companies, right? The fact that we standardized the network and then could start standardizing protocols, you're right. We should have been able to move away from it. But BizTalk, I think, just tried to stay relevant.
Yeah.
Plus, we kept screwing up. These interplay protocols were bad, right? Like, and they were always bad. Like, CORBA was bad.
This is the last, we will go down this rabbit hole. The last video I recorded, we talked about DCOM, a DCOM horror story. So,
oh boy.
And you know, the D stands for dumb.
Welcome to Three Old Guys talking about technology that doesn't exist anymore.
But to your point, it's better now.
Yeah.
Right. Like, we have learned, we have better platforms, we have more standardization, we understand what a cloud proxy is for and why it makes our lives so much better. Like, things are better.
I'll even go farther. The .NET, I mean, we're all .NET guys here. The .NET ecosystem, I think, is just generational vastly better after the .NET Core wave of things.
Yeah.
Some of the low-level abstractions that they put in place, iHost, the iConfiguration, iLogger, the standard interfaces, the iHost builder, so much of that has...
I'm coupling it from Windows entirely. That process, that rethink, just made it a better platform.
Yes. I'm doing this on a Mac. I haven't coded on Windows in years, except for Parallels. Love the new world order.
Now with .NET 9.
Yeah. Well, and in the cloud, you're crazy not to run it on Linux. Run .NET on Linux. It's a 25% discount if you do it.
And add .NET 9 into the mix, and you're using, what, 80% less memory or something crazy like that? .NET 9 uses so much less memory.
I'm not really running apps in production to know that, but I can say every time we get a new .NET version, my build times go down.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cannot complain.
And run times are faster. Like, they really, I don't know how they can keep this up.
Is there a law of this?
At some point, it's only one bit being flipped, and that's just not enough.
There it is. Campbell's law right there.
Yeah.
You heard it here first. We will continue optimizing until there's only one bit.
Yeah, we're down to a bit. Wait, we were going to talk about something today. I'm sure what we were.
We were. Vertical architecture was something you expressed an interest in.
Well, it's taking out the vertical slice architecture. But so this might be a sequel or a continuation of the last time I got together with you guys.
Mm-hmm.
The phrase vertical slice architecture, it's popularized by Jimmy Bogard. In the .NET space, it's, you know, it's very, very tightly associated with Mediator. Of course, Wolverine supports it quite differently, potentially. But I guess maybe stop and, you know, to explain what it is, I always got to stop and contrast it to what's coming before, or what's really the state of the art, or at least a few years ago. I'm sure you guys have plenty of shows folks coming on to talk about clean architecture, onion architecture.
Sure.
Hexagonal ports and adapters.
Yeah, done it.
Right. They've been there, done that. So they're very well-meaning attempts to try to, you know, establish a kind of a standard for a team, get better results of, we want to disentangle business logic from infrastructure. Mm. We'd like to make things testable. And then folks started to throw out all of these enterprise architecture templates, these prescriptive, you know, look at my repository and it'll tell you the umpteen projects you have to divide things into, the rules of what things are called, how they're divided, you know where this goes. So I think we took a couple wrong turns. First thing we did is these templates tend to focus too much on, you know, the nouns of the system. I have an invoice controller that talks to an invoice service that must talk to an invoice repository, and they've all got to be in umpteen different projects, right?
An email sender.
Yeah. And
email service.
You know, every enterprise system grows until there's a messaging service, right?
Right.
Yeah. I've done lots of those. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's made us kind of overemphasize maybe throwing in a lot of abstractions. You know, we maybe took a little too seriously the idea that it has to be possible to swap out your infrastructure at a moment's notice, which, you know, nobody really does, or very rarely, right? Mm. So what happens in bigger enterprise systems is you get these huge horizontal layers where every use case has to bounce through all of these separate layers. And it becomes very difficult to reason about a single use case because it's all mm-hmm. scattered around, mm-hmm. right? You can't really update anything anyway, even though you have these abstractions, because it's a full project to replace the database or upgrade a technology. It's just too big. So the kind of logical reaction to that is the idea of a vertical slice architecture. We're going to primarily organize code. And here I'm just talking about how we situate code. I'm not even really talking about changing the basic abstractions or anything like that, but we're going to try to lean towards organizing code around use cases, or it especially works well with CQRS. I'm going to organize code around the command and everything it takes to handle that command, or a query and everything that takes to query it. Hmm. The general idea is I'm going to take things that are closely related and I'm going to put them together. And things that are not related, I'm going to spread them out.
Mm, right. So the vertical slice starts when somebody clicks a button, let's say, on the website, and ends when there's a result, an end result, whether that goes through a queue or through databases and all these other services. All those things happen in one place that isn't shared with the other slices.
I will go all the way to that extreme. I would say it's perfectly valid to share some helper code, mm-hmm. but, so really think of it as like a single web request. You're issuing a create invoice or approve invoice command to an HTTP endpoint. So everything that it takes to fully apply that, you know, whatever data you need to fetch, reading the HTTP validation, business rules that might have to happen, and finally persistence. Mm-hmm. If you were using, you know, Wolverine, for example, our idiom is to try to push you to really do that in one code file.
Hmm. Hmm. So, I mean, are you talking about everything through all of those layers just being a single app, essentially?
Well, you're separating the UI, though, right?
Yeah. If it's small enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a back-end guy.
Okay.
Nobody would let me do front-end work unless you're desperate.
Yeah, I don't think you'd want to put that code in your UI. Yeah.
No. I mean, there's a follow-up conversation. Get somebody on to talk about composite UI someday, but that's
okay.
So if the use case is small enough, I mean, if it gets big, and you know, it's probably with all those prescriptive templates, they blow up, is sometimes a particular use case may be too big, and then you start splitting things up, helpers. Mm. Maybe you draw out, split off message handlers. Mm. But what we're doing with vertical slice is we're saying, you know, we're not so worried about necessarily swapping out infrastructure. But I'll come back to that. What you want, though, is you want to make it as easy as possible to reason about what is happening in my system from this input to the outputs it makes, because the business logic changes all the time.
Yeah.
And that's where your bug fixes are going to go.
So you're saying if you have everything in one file, you don't have to step through the debugger and find out which modules are being touched and which, where they're coming. And then now you've got this mental list of all these places where you have to make changes. It's all in one file.
In the ideal,
in the ideal usage. Yeah.
You know, some things are going to be too big for that.
You sure.
still have to pull it out. But yeah. Now to your point, I mean, to go into apostasy here, you know, if you're doing it to Wolverine style, we're going to push you to ditch repository layers, or at least as a go-to default move. There's always exceptions. To directly utilize, if you're using EF Core, use a DB context. If you're using Martin, you're going to use iDocument Store, the iDocument session directly, with a huge caveat here. You know, in our case, we want it still to be in one file, but we'll take other steps to isolate the business logic code away from infrastructure. So you can, and kind of, I'll come back to that, but to be able to go right down to the metal, so you can use every last bit of power in your data persistence tooling. You know, you need to fiddle with lazy versus eager fetching to be faster. You need to batch up querying to be faster.
Would you still want to use a CRUD interface? I mean, that's the essence of what a repository is, isn't it? So that you could swap out whatever, you know, database backend for testing, memory repository, for example.
Okay. So this is the part where people are going to give you angry comments later, right?
No, please bring it on.
Get you a little bit of controversy. So we got two issues here. You know, on one hand, what are we going to do to be able to swap out infrastructure, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put a pin in that and come back to it.
Okay.
The second point is, how do I make code testable?
Yeah.
So, especially with the Wolverine style, we're leaning really heavily into an idea from Jim Shore called the A-frame architecture. So, in the show notes, I'll send you a link. There's a paper called Testability Without Mocks. I recommend it to everybody who works with me sooner or later. The A-frame idea.
I like that.
Now, if you're talking about, say, we're building a Wolverine handler, either an HTTP handler or a message handler that is, I mean, let's say it's a proven invoice, right? So you probably need to go get the current state of the invoice, because you may need to look at it. Is it already approved? Is everything done? Has, you know, everybody signed off, whatever it takes, and then decide your business logic, decide, what do I need next? Do I decide to approve it and go on and maybe send out other follow-up messages or not? And then finally persist it. So coming to this idea of an A-frame, I'm not going to worry about interfaces and mock objects or stubs or fakes or anything like that. We're going to divide things up into like kind of a controller on top. The A guy at top, he is going to reach into data persistence. He's going to grab the invoice data for you. Push it into the business logic. Business logic, in the case of Wolverine, we're pushing really hard. We want it to be a pure function.
Now, you keep mentioning Wolverine, but what if people don't use Wolverine and aren't really familiar with it? How can you give us an example that doesn't use Wolverine?
Actually, it's just extracting methods. So whether this was mediator or whatever it's going to be, just say you have a mediator handler, an in-service bus handler, mass transit handler, or just a MVC controller endpoint. What you're really going to do is just build off some helper methods, and that's it. So one method is the controller, MVC controller, is going to talk to EF Core maybe and pull out the invoice information for you.
Okay.
Right.
And then it's going to call into a method that is your actual business logic and say, here's the command. Somebody wants to approve this invoice, and here is the current state of the invoice. And out of that pure function, you tell me what to do next. You're going to return some kind of result that is, here's an event sourcing. It could be, here's an event I want you to append invoice approved, or approval rejected, whatever it's going to be, or maybe something that reflects what to do next. Now, our business function here, I keep saying pure function, you know, we're going to dive into functional programming world a little bit. People are going to make fun of me for this.
No, nobody's making fun of you, dude. Nobody.
No, people will on Blue Sky later. So
nobody,
we want to isolate that business logic where it's not depending on services. There's no interfaces to mock. It's just, if you have this state and this command, what do you do next? You get business logic in place where it's really easy to unit test, no mock setup, no crazy stuff, no in-memory database. I don't care. Mm-hmm. And then the last step, you know, the A-frame, the controller is like, I'm getting stuff for you. I'm pushing into business logic and I'm taking what you decide to do next. And then I'm persisting it back to EF Core maybe, or Martin or whatever it is. And I'm sending out extra messages. So the A-frame architecture, it's really a coding approach, but it's mm-hmm. a way to isolate your business logic without having to throw in a lot of abstractions, a lot of indirections, and throwing out, you know, five different projects like you would in onion architecture.
Right. It simplifies, because that is the fundamental problem of all these architectures, is that they complicate things and they add all these layers of abstraction for the purpose of what? For making it flexible, but then something is ultimately flexible, it's ultimately difficult to use.
It is. Now back to rewind to the point, I think you were correctly challenging, well, what if I want to swap out my database?
Yeah.
Which you're unlikely to do, but you could.
Yeah.
So,
I always find these swap out the database defense a weak defense. It's like, you're probably not going to do that.
You can't because if you have a big enough project and it's a flat layer, you can't, because that's going to be an entire project to do a full regression testing cycle. And most people can't do it. Your business partners will never let you do that.
All right. But I can give you an example where you would use a repository pattern, basically a CRUD interface, right? You could use the same interface on a client to create a repository that makes all your API calls. And you could use the same interface on that same client to do something against the client-side database that I can't even remember the name of it now because I'm stupid. But IDB, something DB, all right?
Well, just local storage. Sure.
Yeah, not local storage, but there's another database that's built into your browser. You can do that, right? And on the back end, if you wanted to run things against a repository that just uses memory collections to test all your stuff. But I think that is where you brought up another thing that you can test without mocking and test without memory databases and things.
Yes. So I want to really want to be able to test the business logic without having to do a bunch of mock setups, you know. If you are as old as us, and I don't think you have to be anywhere near as old as us, you've dealt with code bases where the unit tests were unusually hard to work with because there was too much reliance on mocking libraries or fakes. And those tests become very hard to reason about. They become very brittle because your implementation is too tightly coupled to the lock the system. So
indexed DB, that's what I was trying to remember. Sorry.
Gotcha. I've read about it, never used it. So a couple things. I think your example of using a repository, I think that's perfectly valid. As far as swapping out the technology. So I think the single best thing you can do to make your technology swappable is to invest very heavily in having a very effective test automation infrastructure. That's the one thing that's going to give you enough feedback to do this, because you can't just swap out interfaces if you can't test your app very fast.
Right.
That's one thing. We keep touching on modular monolith a little bit. And I think all this is related. I don't think if you have a big system, it's impossible. It's effectively impossible to swap out infrastructure in most project planning. But if you have a way where you could do it bit by bit, module by module, maybe you could pull that off. Or if you could upgrade from whatever, SQL Server to Postgres for the cheaper hosting, or move to a different NoSQL database, or get off MongoDB or whatever it is. Maybe you can do it one module at a time, right? Couple other things, diving into things like performance and whatnot. These database engines, they do not work the same way at all. EF Core might be a perfectly good abstraction over relational databases, which are much more similar than not. I mean, maybe you can go from SQL Server to Postgres, but going from a relational database to a NoSQL database,
that's
a very different ballgame. The same abstractions are not going to work. Even the link providers, there are a lot of extensions. You know, people use these repository abstractions where they let iQueryable leak out. That's probably a terrible idea.
Yeah, they're no good. That's a terrible idea. And by the way, doesn't work. iQueryable requires code, doesn't it? So
it does, but
it's not data.
To make it fast, your iQueryable is going to need a lot of tool specific usage in a lot of cases.
Yeah, you can't just pass that from a client from an API controller.
Yeah. So
ask me how I know.
Everybody's done that one.
I tried.
To the testability point, you brought up, he's like, EF Core, people get excited about the in-memory provider.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to behave very differently than your real database. It will give you false positive, false negatives. So another thing I'm going to say is when you're picking technologies, you very purposely try to pick technologies that have a very good testability story,
right?
That play very nicely inside of automated testing, which is, to put my money where my mouth is on that one, picking Martin as either document store or event store. Martin has built-in functionality to set up databases on the fly if you're in development or testing time, and it has the ability to wipe your database out in one command line. The point being here is it's actually much friendlier inside of an integrated test harness than we would have been used to 20 years ago, where that was almost impossible.
Yeah. Hey, getting back to my love for repositories, one of the things that I do is I have an EF repository that's generic, and then I have a generic Dapper repository.
Mm-hmm.
I have a generic ADO.net by itself repository. And that's good because, you know, you start out with a customer and they like EF, and then there's something happens, and they're like, no, we don't like this anymore. We want to move to ADO.net. Well, then I'll try Dapper, right? So I'm not really changing the database per se. I'm changing the code that accesses the database. And so that's one of the reasons why. But I want to get your reaction to this after the break, which we're doing right now. We'll be right back. .NET Rocks. Hold on. We'll be right back. Did you know there's a .NET on AWS Community? Follow the social media, blogs, YouTube influencers, and open source projects, and add your own voice. Get plugged into the .NET on AWS Community at aws.amazon.com/.NET.
It's time to play big on Moto Social Casino, America's hottest free-to-play social casino experience. Moto.us has live casino games. It's time! Play big, win bigger on Moto.us today.
Moto is a social casino, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Visit Moto.us for more details.
It's time!
Moto.us.
.NET Rocks. I'm Carl Franklin. That's my friend Richard Campbell.
Hey.
And our friend Jeremy Miller. Hey. And what's your reaction to my love of repositories again? And then we'll get off this, I swear to God.
No, to this point, what if you want to switch quickly between Dapper, RawIDO.net, or EF Core, or you would go old school and bring in Hibernate back, because that does still work.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So if you're doing that, I think you're in a world of, I think that might apply well to more of a CRUD-centric world, where I'm editing an order at a time, I'm adding an invoice at a time. I hate the phrase pick the right tool for the job, but pick the right tool for the job. Most of what I'm talking about, I do deal with larger systems with a lot more workflow, a lot more complexity than a CRUD system.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about, I think that's fine for something that's mostly about editing data.
Mm-hmm.
But right off the bat, so, you know, Richard's an old database guy.
What do you mean old? He's not old.
Sorry. So
no older than you.
there are these
by 2 weeks.
You can write really bad database, you know, database SQL queries.
Sure.
My experience, can't speak for everybody else. My experience, by far and away, the worst cause of very poor performance with the database is being chatty, making way too many calls back and forth to the database. Even to the point where, you know, in these layering things where you might be calling for the same data over and over and over again, and you don't even know it because you can't see it. So taking that as an example, say you have, this is pretty common, you have a web request, and in the course of handling it, you need to look up three or four different entities at a time.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. And if you take some kind of repository abstraction approach, you don't have to do this, but you probably fall down that path of having a totally separate repository for each entity type, right? Mm. Or that's common. Mm-hmm. That's almost forcing you to do a very naive, least common denominator approach of, I'm going to go reload one, then load the second, then load the third. You may even be doing an N plus one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of queries that just doesn't fit.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why we have stored procedures, isn't it? You know, we have a procedure that gets, okay, he's just wincing now. He's wincing. He's got his fingers over his eyes.
There's a politer way to say that, which is, but there's an opportunity for DBAs to provide optimizations to you.
Yes, of course. I mean, this is one of the reasons why stored procedures exist, right? Besides became into being, shall I say, because of the abstraction one, but also because we could do complex queries and return complex result sets.
So technically, yes, but to our point about trying to prefer tools that give you easier time and integration testing.
Sure.
If you're depending on stored procedures and stored procedures with logic, you have made your code as hard to test as it possibly can.
I totally agree. And I have since sworn them off, Jeremy. I have, I swear to God.
No, and stored procedures should be the exception. Like, we can't seem to make this go any faster. What do we got to do? And the DBA can help.
Yes. But the point I was getting at is, but also say you're using a NoSQL database.
Yep.
Or, you know, for me, most of my clients are using Event Store. One where using an Event Store tool, so you're dealing with projections and all kinds of things.
Yeah. But
the point is, your underlying tool probably has some kind of special sauce power to do batch query. Mm-hmm. Martin, for example, will let you line up, I want to run this link query, load this entity, load that entity, and go do it in one batch. But it'll also say, I want to load this entity, but I want you to find its related thing here and its third related thing and do it in one network round trip.
Yeah,
that is a massive cost savings in terms of performance.
Sure.
So being able to go right to the metal, you're not really going that close, but using all the power that your underlying infrastructure has, mm-hmm. and then putting it in one vertical slice where you can actually reason about what are the database queries I'm actually making from this system input to get my data out. That's going to give you the best possible chance of getting something that's very performant.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the second vertical slice you're going to take? Like, you talk about the vertical slice approach to get started, essentially. Like, let's get something running, a particular feature set, end to end. You know, at one time, even in Agile, we want to call that a spike. Like, we're going to test this thing. My concern with this approach is always then more teams start working on their slices and we're duplicating work, or we're coming with different styles, or, you know, they don't interplay with each other very well.
So a lot of that's going to boil down to communication. Mm-hmm. But that also gets into a conversation I did want to have with you guys. You know, the folks that really like to have those prescriptive architectures, some of it is about standardization, and taking away people need to be creative or think kind of straitjacketed into doing a one way thing.
Hmm. Right. But there is one right way for this app.
Yeah. So I'm a huge sports fan, right? And if you follow your team long enough, you're going to hear the phrase a lot of, this player is a high I4 player, or this other player could raise the ceiling of the team. And all it means is, when you talk about a player's floor ceiling, you kind of say, we expect to be at least this good. That's the floor. When you say raising the ceiling, we could potentially be even this much better. Folks that really care about standardization across teams, they're trying to raise the floor.
Right.
They're trying to say, I want a minimum quality by saying, everybody just do it the exact same way. Theoretically, you can move around. People don't have to think so much. They can just go. There's obvious value. There's obvious attraction. The only problem is it doesn't work very well, right? you get these one-size-fits-all templates.
Yeah.
What happens is you get use cases that are vastly more complicated than your clean architecture approach shows. Yep. If you make people stop thinking, like I'm straight-jacketed into this approach, they stop thinking and they start writing just those massive bloated MVC controllers, which led to Mediator pulling it out. Now you have bloated Mediator handlers. People forget to do things like, I'm just going to extract a helper method out and compose my method. Or you, on the other side of things, your prescriptive template may be more complicated than it should be, and you get a lot of straight pass-throughs.
Right.
I've seen that as well. So
now this is always a challenge. If it's simple enough to use, it's not sophisticated enough to do what you need to do. And if it's sophisticated enough to use, it's too complicated to understand.
So, you know, the duplication, I mean, that's a real problem. That's absolutely a legitimate concern. What I would say is communication between teams. Hopefully your team is still working in a, you know, a kind of a DDD style bounded context where they have an isolated purview to some degree, and then there's not much natural duplication except in infrastructure.
Right.
You know, being able to rotate around teams, you know, this is orthogonal to architectural style. In places where you do see duplication in code, you start to do some refactorings to gather up the duplication, just like we've always done.
In some ways, I can almost see you describing this as a good problem. You've gotten to a place where you've built enough that they can see the duplication, and now you can put an initiative to try and consolidate that and make things a bit more efficient. I would also think the first slice you pick in a greenfield app is going to set the tone, so pick carefully.
Maybe, yeah. But taking this, you know, down the people side of things, you know, rather than saying, here's this very limited straitjacket rule of, you know, we downloaded somebody's GitHub repository that lays out a clean architecture or something or other.
Right.
Having a constant learning environment where your people are empowered to learn and experiment a little bit, as long as you can trust that they'll communicate with each other. So that's what I would describe as raising the ceiling of your, right. Shop, you know, you have a chance to do things much better.
I think it's reasonable to set minimums, but don't require where people stay at the minimums. Like I think I have to enough smart enough to go when to know when they're going below it, but not be concerned when they go above it, because that's ultimately a good thing.
Definitely that. And then all of us learn, if you're ever a technical lead, sooner or later you're going to learn a hard, rough lesson that the more specific direction you give to somebody working with you, the worse the results are coming back.
Sure.
Because if you turn off their brain, you make them just...
I don't know. I've seen Carl do this with music where he pointed the bass player and said, just be awesome.
Just be awesome. That's a true story.
The true story. You know what?
He says, what do you want me to play here?
He was awesome.
I said, just be awesome. And he was.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But you know, I could think of some devs where all you need to tell them is, hey, just be awesome.
Just be awesome. Don't write bugs.
Well, yeah. And then let me rein some of that in of, you know, also folks, don't get too creative. Don't get too crazy. No matter what tool you use, use it in the idiomatic way. Don't write your own special frameworks, that kind of thing.
I remember the Onion article, Apple employee fired for thinking too different.
The way I always pitched it to my devs was, I want you to be able to take a vacation. So somebody else needs to be able to read this code.
Yeah, that's right? Sure. Like, good motivation.
It's just, you know, be able to give yourself a break.
So running right back to our vertical slice architecture idea, we are trying very hard, you know, and again, I'm still plugging it. The approach we're taking with Wolverine is especially shrink your code down. Take out so much code ceremony that you can hopefully very easily reason about your system. It's all in one place. There's less code, period. There's less hoops to jump through. And even a strange person could come in, as long as they are a developer, they can see, yeah, I understand how it's working top to bottom.
I get this. Yeah. And so maybe you can actually take 2 weeks off and the world doesn't hold still or burn to the ground.
Well, I'll let you know if I ever do.
I always thought it was a good milestone, right? Was like, are we functioning enough of the team that somebody can go away for a while? And not that we don't burn to the ground or even that we can hold everything still, but that we still made progress without them.
Yeah.
They came back to not an inbox that killed them, that punished them for taking their time off.
I think I've told this story before. The first project where I was a technical lead on a project that was actually important, all of my managers 2 or 3 times a day would ask me, well, what are we going to do if you get hit by a bus?
Right.
Yeah, that's a very real thing.
And I heard that so often that I started seriously pondering my own mortality.
Yeah.
And like, it got,
why do you want to hit me with a bus so bad?
Isn't that one of Steve Smith's anti-patterns or whatever? The bus,
being hit by a bus is definitely an anti-pattern.
No. But you know,
the one bus, low bus factor.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Low bus factor. Yeah. But that's why I went with the vacation scenario, because it seems less, you know, mortally threatening.
It's less morbid. It's a very Canadian approach to that metaphor.
I was just going to say, I'm an American. I don't know what a 2-week vacation would be like. I mean, I've had one once, maybe.
Right.
Better software through politeness.
Yeah. Just trying to keep people healthy and happy, you know. We took over a team that had been death marching for like 6 months, and the boss is like, what do you suggest? This is, I'm thinking a 3-week, I'm thinking a 3-day weekend first, just send everybody home for 3 days, take a breath. We'll reorganize next week.
And absolutely. Try to figure out what we're
gonna do. You know, you can't just keep beating people. We're not making progress anymore and everyone's miserable.
Got to get up and take a walk once in a while.
I can only say I haven't been on a death march in a few years, but yeah. I certainly did my share of them back in the waterfall days.
Mm. Yeah, well, and it's one of those things where we everybody's built their parts and you've tested in various bits and now you're trying to really get to a deployment and does it actually scale the way it's supposed to behave and are the people happy with it? And then it's patch, like what are we missing? Trying to get to that magic V1 that somebody promised on an arbitrary date they didn't understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the day as a tech lead, the tester asked me, what about the reports from the requirements? And I don't know what you're talking about. And there was a second requirements document I had never been shown until then.
Yeah.
And we were already in the official testing phase.
Yeah. Mm. Surprise.
Yeah.
Should have known about this a year ago.
Waterfall for the win.
Abbreviated WTF. Waterfall.
Oh my goodness.
What's in your inbox, Jeremy? What are you going to do next?
So, probably won't show up in a conference until later next year. I did so many late last year that I didn't get submissions off. But the big thing I'm working on right now, my company, Jasper FX Software, working on a tool called Critter Watch that is going to be commercial management console monitoring tool specifically for the entire critter stack. So everything you would need to not just watch what's going on in your system, but also be able to help heal the system, deal with the letter queue messages. Event sourcing creates all kinds of extra stuff. I have problems of being able to kick off projection rebuilds, rewind subscriptions, turn things on, change what servers things are running on, maybe to deal with privacy concerns, be able to retroactively say, we're going to do something called crypto shredding. We're just going to throw away the key so we can't read this client data anyway. Mm. You know, all kinds of good stuff like that. So trying to make the jump from, you know, we're a services company around open source tooling right now, but we want to make the jump to also having that paid commercial add-on model.
Very cool.
Cool.
Well, I hope you come back and talk to us when that's in play, you know, or if you have any other things that are new, just feel free to reach out and come back on the show.
All right. We'll certainly do that. Guys, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
It's been a pleasure for us too. And we'll talk to you next time on .NET Rocks.
.NET Rocks is brought to you by Franklin's Net and produced by Quap Studios, a full-service audio, video, and post-production facility located physically in New London, Connecticut, and of course in the cloud. Online at pwop.com. Visit our website at dotnetrocks.com for RSS feeds, downloads, mobile apps, comments, and access to the full archives going back to show number one, recorded in September 2002. And make sure you check out our sponsors. They keep us in business. Now go write some code. See you next time.
MODO.US for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. Modo offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games and now introducing live blackjack, roulette, and casino hold'em. These are so much fun. Modo always has generous jackpots, free spins, and exciting promotions. Register today at MODO.US for your free welcome bonus.
Modo is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
MODO.US.
Mom, you're playing your game again?
I can't help it. I love Hexasort and getting to the next level.
Melt into your couch with the Hexasort app by Lion Studios, the original Hexasorting game. Sort, organize, stack. Your favorite sound will be winning at Hexasort. Imagine craving your couch to play Hexasort, and a month later, you're at level 436. Download Hexasort today on the App Store or Google Play. Hexasort by Lion Studios, the original Hexasorting game. Download today.